Welcome to The Babblery, conversations where we explore the knowledge, opinions, passions, and obsessions of my guests. This is Suki Wessling, and today's program was recorded for Talk of the Bay on KSQD 90.7 FM Santa Cruz, California, streaming online at www.ksqd.org. Welcome to Talk of the Bay, KSQD's local news program brought to you every weekday at 5 p.m. I'm your host, Suki Wessling. A few weeks ago, the four of us involved in this roundtable conversation discussed doing a show about the end of Roe v. Wade as a hypothetical. By the time we got together to record this conversation, Roe v. Wade was no longer law of the land. This show will air July 4th, by which time abortion will be restricted or illegal in a growing number of states. Other states are working on increasing abortion access with the assumption that they will need to serve both their own population and those who come from restricted states. We are located in California, and our governor and legislature have declared that our state will be an abortion sanctuary state, protecting women and providers in California from abortion bans by other states and facilitating travel from other states. And it's a confusing time. Some people in this country have worked hard for this end and are celebrating, but the overwhelming majority who support legal abortion in some form are confused about what comes next. I'm joined by three people involved in different ways in the medical community in California. Pam Connolly is Chief Operations Officer at Encompass Community Services in Santa Cruz, which provides services in behavioral health, family and social well-being, early childhood education, and housing. Pam is also a board member of Planned Parenthood Marmonte. Welcome, Pam.
Good to be here, Suki. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Jen Hastings is a family physician and assistant clinical professor at the UCSF Department of Family and Community Medicine and was the physician at Westside Planned Parenthood from 1998 to 2018. Jen is engaged in research on trans and gender expansive reproductive justice issues. Welcome, Jen.
Thank you so much, Suki. Thanks for having this conversation.
And Dr. Gail Newell is an OBGYN, health officer for the County of Santa Cruz, and associate clinical professor at UCSF. Welcome, Gail.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here with you and my colleagues.
So I just wanted to start with a reality check. How are you all feeling? Gail, why don't you start?
Well, thanks for asking that question. This really hit me harder than I thought. I'm talking about the overturning of Roe versus Wade, the 1973 landmark decision. And I was intellectually prepared for that to happen after the leak of the draft Supreme Court ruling. But it really hit me harder than I thought it would. And I also realized that this is a much bigger issue than just about abortion, that we're talking about sexism and racism and some really huge systemic issues. So I know we're hoping to talk about that a little today.
Yes, indeed. How about you, Jen?
Well, I'll echo Gail's experience that while I knew that this was coming, it's been devastating on a very sort of physical level. I find it hard to breathe. And I'm grieving. I'm very afraid about what's happening in our country, and the lives of many people are now threatened. And we can talk more about the consequences and what life was like before we had legal abortion and the consequences of returning to a country where legal abortion is not available, legal and safe abortion is not available, is really hard to imagine that we're here. We're joined by only a few countries and countries that don't have a lot of other freedoms. So this is really concerning on many levels. And what we're looking, what will be coming next is actually terrifying to contemplate.
Okay. And Pam, go ahead.
You know, the same words come to mind, devastated, and I just feel really concerned, really worried. I, as someone who has had abortions, I understand the impact of accessing this very basic healthcare medical intervention that can make on your life. And I feel worried about, at the very basic level, about folks not being able to access the healthcare that they need. I'm so worried for the future and feeling incredibly overwhelmed kind of by the now what.
The now what? I like that. That's a good way of putting it. You know, one of the things that makes abortion different from all the other types of controversial policy decisions that we have to make in this country is that there's a deep cultural stigma attached to it. Although abortion is a common part of healthcare, people don't talk about it. So we don't have a sense of what our acquaintances think about it. Pam, can you talk a little bit about what's behind this stigma?
Yeah, I think, you know, stigma around a number of populations or experiences for folks who maybe have HIV/AIDS or are part of the LGBT community. We see that in our culture all the time. We see this coming out in pride events for, you know, folks who are LGBT. We see it in reflected in healthcare practices. So the stigma is pervasive, I think, in a healthcare culture, just related to kind of discrediting folks when they don't fit into someone's idea of a social norm or what kind of appropriate behaviors. For abortion stigma, I think it's important to remember that it does interact and impact policy. I think it's very rooted, and I know we'll get to this a little bit later, but it's very rooted in this idea of, I think, gender and power. And in order for stigma to be effective and impactful, there has to be a power component. And that's certainly the case when it comes to people controlling their reproduction. I think it's rooted in this belief about morality and behavior. There's so much research about stigma out there. I mean, it's just, there's more and more, and there's a wealth of it to tap into, but also about the role of women in our society, kind of culturally, the role of, historically, the role of women, kind of rooted in that idea of gender and power, and really our ideas, kind of the constructs, these ideas that we have about women, you know, that women, you know, sex for procreation, this idea that women are made for, you know, carrying and birthing children, kind of this inevitability of motherhood, kind of the expectation of motherhood or parenthood. And then kind of the way that women are seen to be these kind of never ending kind of vessels of nurturing for vulnerable. And so all of those things, I think, really tie into the stigma of abortion. When women, you know, choose to have an abortion or choose to be child-free by choice or choose to, let's say, join the military, our ideas about what a woman should be in these contexts of, in these kind of those three things that I've just described, kind of blow that out of the water, and we don't really know what to do with these women. So I think a lot of that is kind of the stigma around having an abortion, providing an abortion, supporting someone who's had an abortion, kind of rooted in those ideas. And those are really deep-seated and kind of hard to shake for us. But it's really powerful. I think that, that stigma, not only is the stigma harmful for folks to experience that, right? If you're experiencing stigma, your health outcomes will be poorer. You might not access care that you need. You might not have social connections that you need to be healthy. And that it prevents you, the stigma then prevents you from sharing, which perpetuates the stigma. And so if there are ways that we can kind of disrupt the stigma around people having an abortion or providing abortions or supporting folks who have an abortion, that we can kind of get some agency back and kind of set our own agenda about the variety of choices we have when it comes to building a family, raising a family, not having a family, as well as kind of weaving in this idea of reproductive justice, which is, you know, that the option to have a family, the option to not have a child, have a child, not have a child, and to parent a child in safe spaces. And that's kind of that intersection of kind of reproductive rights and race and economic justice. So those are my, you know, my big zoom out thoughts about stigma and how when you don't have those conversations and the stigma is perpetuated, it allows for this thing to occur that we're seeing right now, in that largely people in the United States support abortion and a woman's right to choose, and yet our policy is not reflecting that. And so I think that's where it really is impacting, you know, what we're seeing play out in policy, is that we don't always feel empowered to speak up and say, I know someone who I love someone, or I know someone who's had an abortion. I believe in someone's right to an abortion, and yet we're kind of quiet, kind of afraid to say it, call it the A word. I have a friend who is from Belfast, and she talks about how the lower your voice gets about something, the more frightening you find it. So it's like, oh, she had a child out of wedlock. Oh, she had an abortion. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's like we can't speak up, and thereby we just kind of keep perpetuating it.
Yeah, and it you know, it seems to me like I've had bazillions of conversations about all sorts of things with all the women I know, but when I went onto Facebook the day that the ruling was released, I realized that a large number of people that I know, I had no idea what their position would be. And that's sort of, for something so fundamental and that we argue about so much, that's really surprising. And I believe that, you know, comes from this stigma. It's not like you just, you know, having coffee with somebody and discussing, you know, the project you're working on at work. So have you had an abortion? You know, we don't really, so it doesn't become part of our national discussion on a personal level, the way that so many other things can quickly become personal. Right?
Yeah,
like, you know, the price of gas, you can make that personal immediately.
Yeah. I think it's such a good point, because reproduction is around us all the time. We're humans, you know? And for some reason, we really struggle with this idea of choice. And then if you think about kind of the impact of internalized stigma for someone who's had an abortion, this stigma is so powerful that I've heard people say, I had an abortion, but I don't believe in it. And I don't think it's right. And other people should not have abortions. But my particular circumstances, I had an abortion for whatever legitimate reasons, or, you know, X, Y, and Z. And so it's a really powerful stigma that someone can exist in both of those spaces at the same time, where I've had one and yet it's not right and it's not okay. And so I feel like it's a hard one to dismantle. When I was working at the Sea Change program several years ago, we worked on a book called Untold Stories. And it's life, love, and reproduction. And it's a number of stories about reproductive choices. And the idea was that we tapped into existing book groups so that folks could read this book and share experiences. And what we learned is that in that intimate setting, just like you mentioned, Suki, about your Facebook feed, is that once the conversation, there was the conduit or the mechanism for the conversation to happen, the safe space for it to happen, that it begins to happen. And when you can share those stories of, you know, oh, you had a miscarriage, or you suffered from postpartum depression, or you had an abortion, that you can connect quickly when you're allowed to, and you can recognize the humanity in someone when you're, when you've kind of been given the space and you're allowed to.
Yeah. The stigma is really then what you're saying at the root of a lot of the, I guess I'd call it the secondary politics, because there are those people who are firmly anti-abortion and who specifically vote for politicians, political parties, and anyone who they consider to be anti-abortion. So, but then there's clearly there's a whole lot of people voting for politicians that they don't agree with on that issue, which is really interesting to me.
Yeah, I think it really points back to how complex this is and how complex our ideas are about parenting, and kind of the role of, I don't want to get too convoluted here, but the role of women in our culture, especially related to unpaid labor, and how that shows up, and how when you kind of hold those structures up for this kind of unpaid workforce, and you keep someone barefoot and pregnant, that you can still tap into that, and you can keep folks in lower pay. You know, this is where we have to really think hard about how these decisions impact communities of color, mm-hmm. because it is a component of keeping folks in a space of low wage labor. And when you can't control your reproduction and you become trapped in the cycle of feeding your family and going to work, cleaning houses and feeding your family and having children, that we can maintain that, you know, that kind of low wage workforce. Uh-huh. I mean, that may sound convoluted. It doesn't feel to me, but
but when you trace those lines, and I know, you know, anti-abortion arguments almost always focus on the rights of the fetus. But the other day when we spoke, Jen, you said something that I wanted to delve into a little bit more. You said that this decision is rooted in misogyny, racism, and power. Can you elaborate on that?
I hold that opinion deeply, and I think it was Gail who actually said that statement.
Oh, okay.
So let's turn to Gail, but I wholeheartedly agree in that statement, and I think it's power. If one just reads the Alito sort of the words in the Roe v. Wade dismantlement of Roe v. Wade, it's just deeply throughout that. So Gail, go for it.
Well, it's a really sensitive topic when we're talking about reproductive rights and contraceptive access and abortion access. You know, the roots of Planned Parenthood are based in a history of wanting to ensure controlled birth rate in more vulnerable communities, in communities of color, and to promote birth rates among the white population, more affluent. And we're hearing that from some of our more conservative and right-wing politicians, even now, that this fear of the communities of color overtaking the white population, and how abortion is partly to blame. And that is not at all true. That is not the case. That's not born in fact.
Isn't the fact actually the opposite, that people of color get abortions at higher rates? I think because I know that the socioeconomic factor is really huge in abortion, right?
No. Okay. We don't have great data, especially in California, which is one of the states that doesn't keep data on race and ethnicity around abortion. So we in California don't collect demographics. But what we do know from studies is that actually 60% of abortions are in the white population. And so probably pretty representative nationally of our national demographics.
Okay. Well, sorry for misquoting that. I read that in something I read just when I was preparing for this, that so that's good to know that it's not actually true?
We do certainly know that Black, Indigenous, and other people of color and gender expansive people bear additional burdens that make reproductive rights and sexual health care more important for those populations and more difficult to access and more stigmatizing. And so those populations do need an extra, we need to ensure that they have access as well as all of the rest of us. But I'm thinking more about the roots of abortion and reproductive rights and the systemic sexism, misogyny, racism that this overturning decision represents in our society. And also in my world, in public health, you would think that abortion was a regular topic of conversation, and yet the word is hardly ever mentioned.
Wow.
And we've talked about the importance of making sure that everyone has access to abortion and reproductive rights. And yet, because of the Hyde Amendment, health centers who receive federal funding are not allowed to provide abortion, to even counsel about abortion. And so our federally qualified health centers, where most of our Santa Cruz Medi-Cal patients receive their care and have their primary health care providers, is very limited in what can be said and the referrals that can be made to abortion. So even right here in Santa Cruz County, we're seeing the inequity that an insured patient can have access to abortion services in a different way than our most vulnerable populations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, you know, I always find that so hard to get my head around. And, you know, you were talking about the roots being in power. And clearly that's true, because the same people who would support the Hyde Amendment often are people who talk a lot about freedom of speech. And to tell a medical worker that they can't even say if a patient asks them where to go for an abortion, that's clearly not freedom of speech. It's something very different, power related.
And even more frightening now, since the overturn and some of my obstetrics colleagues and gynecology colleagues who are practicing in other states are already reporting life-threatening consequences of this ruling. For example, two nights ago in another state, a woman presented with an ectopic pregnancy, so a pregnancy that's not in her uterus. It's an extremely life-threatening condition. And the lawyers for the hospital where she presented got involved, and there was a 9-hour delay in getting her to the operating room because they had to give their approval for the procedure, the life-saving surgery, which is the only treatment for this condition. And in the meantime, she hemorrhaged into her abdomen and nearly died. And so these things are already happening as a result of this Supreme Court ruling.
Yeah.
So very real consequences.
Yeah. One thing that I read was one of the problems is that even within the community of healthcare providers, the phrase that they use legally, you know, the life or the health of the pregnant person, that isn't defined. I mean, an ectopic pregnancy should just be check a box. Yeah, go for it. Right. I mean,
right.
Is there any ectopic pregnancy where you would say, oh no, this is going to be fine? You know,
no, by definition, an ectopic pregnancy is not viable and will threaten the life of the mother.
Yeah. So it seems like that's a one place maybe the healthcare providers need to work in states where they're still allowing abortion for the health or safety of the mother, you know, that they could work with the state to define that so that it's quicker, easier? Do you think, would you feel that that's even a possibility, or are these laws so rooted in power over people that people on the lawmaking side wouldn't be as willing to discuss that?
I believe that those situations are clearly defined already. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has worked very hard at maintaining reproductive rights for pregnant people and people who can get pregnant throughout the country. And I really believe that these are all clearly defined and that there are rare cases that are in the gray zone. However, even with an ectopic pregnancy, you can see a heartbeat on ultrasound at times. And that presents a real ethical dilemma for folks who call themselves pro-life, even though it comes down to the choice between a mother and that, or the person, the pregnant person and the fetus.
Mm-hmm. You know, we have... I noticed myself doing this, and all of us are trying to change our language and be more inclusive. But I had this thought about this when we say the pregnant person or pregnant people, that I think it's so important for people to hear that and remember that people are people. Pregnancy only happens to people who have, you know, functioning uteruses, but all people are affected by pregnancy and abortion. And it's not just a women's issue that, you know, it's been relegated to this corner, but it's really not. It's a human issue.
Very well said.
So anyway, just to say that as we stumble and try to be more inclusive in our language, I think that it's a really useful and good thing to do.
Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah. Go ahead, Pam.
Might I ask the question of Gail, just maybe to share thoughts about Black maternal health outcomes related to reduced abortion? Any conversations that might be happening in your circles related to that?
Yeah, so Black maternal health in this country, Black pregnant people have 4 times the risk of death during pregnancy or the postpartum period compared to all other women, not just white women, but all other women. And so this is a phenomenal risk and something that has to be taken into account when Black people of reproductive potential are making decisions about their bodies and their reproductive rights and contraceptive choices, all of that. So very good point.
Yeah, I read that, you know, Michigan right now, I hope this will be resolved quickly, but these states that have the abortion bans from the 19th century still on their books, which, I don't know, from the perspective of someone who's not a politician, it just what makes me want to shake the politicians and say, why didn't you do that in 1974? You know, take care of that right away. But anyway, but they still have them. So that then the question, you know, will this ban happen? And I read an article about Michigan and they're saying, you know, they can predict how many people will die. And, you know, that's, to me, it's just such a tragedy to even in modern United States be even having to do that, that they're having to look at their state and say, okay, you know, what is the, especially because there's a large Black population, and so they're going to be hit really hard because of those outcomes.
And I kind of want, if we can, link abortion stigma to the point we're making now about mortality during pregnancy. So many times people say, well, an abortion isn't safe, when in fact, the data is very clear that an abortion is much safer than carrying a pregnancy to term. And that misinformation, see, it's astounding to me that the misinformation about your risk of dying with abortion being so much higher is just, no matter how much we try to give solid data about the risk of death in pregnancy being greater than abortion, it doesn't land. And I just sort of returning to like, what's the definition of stigma? It's a word that we use a lot, but I'm just the negative and shaming treatment of any person who chooses to have an abortion or is associated with an abortion. And I just find it fascinating the power of abortion stigma in our culture. Pam, you were quite eloquent about this. And so many times in my career when I was providing abortions, you know, one or two times a week, there would be people who would say, I'm against abortion, but in this case, in my case, I need this abortion. And it's a fascinating kind of human reaction. And I think a baby is a precious thing. Bringing life into the world is like a miracle. It is extraordinary. And it's not always the right time. I guess I'm speaking the obvious here, but I kind of want to bring it back to how can we as a culture, as communities, grow to come to have empathy and understanding for people who make a decision that's right for themselves.
Yeah. And, you know, psychologists and philosophers have done lots of tests where they try to figure out the difference that people see and how that might how it might affect their view of getting an abortion versus not doing anything, which results in a baby, supposedly, although it often doesn't. But psychologically, humans have a very different concept when you actively do something and when you passively allow something to happen. So it is not okay to kill someone, but it is okay for many people not to save someone. So in a different sort of different way. So our brains are already set up that way. And so abortion is an act that the person takes knowing the outcome. Whereas for a lot of people, it's very much more comfortable to say, well, it doesn't matter that pregnancy is more dangerous because you're not doing anything in pregnancy. They're thinking of that as the default of maintaining the pregnancy and delivering the baby. It's a really interesting thing about human psychology, one that's hard to sort of wrap your head around sometimes.
It makes me think about how much Americans love healthcare. We just love our healthcare, and that we participate in medical intervention all the time. We gobble it up. We love it. And how it is the stigma around ideas of parenting and, you know, I won't say it's all carried in faith or religion. I think there's a component of that that's built in, but that this comes with a particular stigma that IVF doesn't come with, that other types of medical intervention come with. I think one thing that I could maybe compare it to is folks receiving medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder. But I think that it is an interesting thing to think about because, I mean, it's 20% of our GDP. We love it. We love our healthcare. It opens our economy. And every time we get a hangnail, we want an MRI. But this particular medical intervention is so loaded for us culturally, for a lot of the reasons Gail mentioned about race and power and our cultural ideas about, I'll use the word motherhood because I do think it's rooted in the ideas about what women are supposed to do in our society or not do in our society.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't have yet enough experience with trans men to have those deeply rooted ideas of what they're supposed to do with their bodies. So that's an interesting thing to look forward to, seeing what our culture does with that. I mean, I know I've read about trans men who have become pregnant and had babies, and so like everything, it'll become more well known as people tell people about it and then what does our culture do with it? It'll be interesting to see.
Brings us back to the importance of storytelling again, and how important it is to become visible and share our stories and how impactful that is on reducing stigma. So even within the healthcare system itself, the word abortion is rarely used. It's rarely talked about, even within healthcare, certainly within public health. I was part of a national working group and study group on abortion in public health, the role of abortion in public health. And we couldn't even get much of the country to the table because they weren't allowed to participate in that topic, a discussion about that topic. And so much of our maternal child health comes down to us through federal funding streams that are many decades old now, that focus completely on the role of the mother and making better mothers as defined long ago, based on these ideals of what a mother should be and do. So even the stigma within the world of public health and healthcare system is so prevalent. Mm-hmm. And storytelling is one of the many ways that we can work on that.
Certainly. And that's something that the power of storytelling, I actually got into that discussion with a UCSC chemist that I interviewed a couple weeks ago. And he talked about how as scientists, which, you know, includes medical personnel, you want to talk about the data. And the data is what, you know, when we look at the data about Black maternal health and death rate, that convinces us. But it's the stories that convince most people. That most people, their brains are set up to understand stories and to make their decisions through stories. And stories are extremely powerful that way. So people can tell those stories and you know, not only just tell the story of their own experience with abortion, which is not, you know, it's everybody's choice how much to talk about their own personal experience, but just to be willing to talk about it with people who might disagree with them and say, I don't really want to have a political discussion, but, you know, and then talk about a story. And you can definitely reach people that way.
I think it's important to remember, like, that, you know, stories are the way that we connect with each other, right? And like you've just mentioned, but the power of telling your story, because storytelling is a legitimate way of kind of coping with stress. So telling your story can help you feel better and process out loud with someone that you're connecting with. And that there, you know, as far as, so it's the storytelling is helping the person who's telling the story, but it's also creating this space for connection. And it is a really powerful tool for connecting. I think it's important to remember that not all abortion storytellers are met with open arms. I worked with a young woman, Renee Bracey Sherman. She's now the executive director of We Testify. It's a national abortion storytelling movement. She received death threats. She was under fire all the time. It was a lot of emotional labor that we expected this young woman of color to do for the benefit of our social fabric. And we need to make sure that we're not just uplifting those voices, but that we are supporting the folks who are telling their abortion stories. Yeah. Because it's not always a mechanism for connecting often, but sometimes it's a mechanism for further stigmatizing, discrediting, devaluing that person, and putting them in a place where they don't matter, which is essentially what stigma is, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's get to more specifics about how California's status as about California's status as a sanctuary state. So, you know, it's a great idea in theory, but in reality, California has more fake crisis pregnancy centers than we do abortion clinics by a large margin. 22 of our counties, which are all located in the more conservative eastern side of the state, have no abortion clinics. So so I'd love to move this conversation now to what happens now. What do we have right now? And you know, Gail, maybe you can give us a good description of getting an abortion, accessing abortion services in California. And then if we do have this predicted influx of people, what happens?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, many of our primary care settings, our federally qualified health centers and community clinics, are not allowed to discuss abortion as an option, much less provide abortion. I know behind a closed door, most providers do have an ethical and moral obligation they feel to disclose a woman's, a pregnant person's, someone with reproductive potential to all of their various options. And so there is some going on there, but it's definitely harder for our more vulnerable populations to access abortion as well as other reproductive rights. And the same is true within Catholic healthcare systems, which are very prevalent in our state, including here in Santa Cruz County. And so there's pockets of access, but it's certainly not universal. But we are so fortunate in California to have the political will and force to be a sanctuary state. And in Santa Cruz County in particular, to have leadership that has pledged to ensure access to abortion and other reproductive rights. But there are big areas of California, as you mentioned, where this is not the case. My 30 years of clinical practice were in Fresno, in the Central Valley. And the situation is very different there, with very different pressures from what we call the Bible Belt of California.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it occurs to me that when it comes to women who have less money, they're less likely to be flying in. So if you fly from someplace, it's cheapest to go to LA or San Francisco or San Jose, someplace where you probably will be able to get an abortion pretty close to the airport. You won't be ending up spending, you know, all having to rent a car and all of these other things that you would have to do. But for women and, you know, for people who are driving into California, the first place you hit is the east side of California, which currently is a complete desert as far as abortion clinics go. I assume that that doctors who are willing to provide, say, medication abortion, or hospitals that there would give a medically necessary abortion in the east side of California. But for someone coming in looking for a clinic, they're not going to find it.
I just want to add that, and something that's not unique to California, but not every state does. You mentioned the Hyde Amendment, Gail. That was a 1976 ruling, I believe, that basically said that federal funds could not be used for the provision of abortion. And a lot of our community clinics get federal funds. And that's kind of the reason that community clinics cannot. But we do, our Medi-Cal, which is our Medicaid for low-income residents of California, our Medi-Cal does pay for abortion, which is true in, I believe, New York, Massachusetts, Oregon, Washington State, the Illinois, I believe, as well. So that is very, you know, a very important part or aspect of care for our Californians. The other thing that I want to say in preparation for this moment in time where we now are, where we do not have Roe v. Wade, there is a commitment from the state of California, and there was preparation already at the end of the year in 2021 to create what they called the California Future of Abortion Council. And so that a group of, you know, stakeholders in California came together to work to propose legislation that would support what we anticipate to be quite a significant influx of people coming from states where it is no longer possible or legal to have an abortion. And that legislation includes protections for medical providers, protections for individuals seeking abortion, and training money to have more abortion providers, and to specifically have more abortion providers to reflect the people that are needing abortions, which will be people of color and low-income people. And so specific training funds for that. The other thing that I want to say is the piece of information that Gail has said now, really important barrier to care, is our community health centers. So figuring out a creative solution to address, to basically move around the Hyde Amendment to have specifically designated funds for the provision of abortion within community health centers, because abortion belongs in community health centers, and it is primary care people who will be able to do the best possible care, knowing their own patients. So this is a very important step forward. It's something that we've all been thinking about for a long time, something that we needed to do because we had Medi-Cal providing, you know, sort of our, it didn't force us. We were not forced until this point to really look at how community health centers could be providing abortion care in California. Mm-hmm. It's an extremely important access point for abortion care. And I think we'll probably really begin to move the needle around what's the, you know, the destigmatizing, that's the word I want, the destigmatizing of abortion care, to really begin to expand that understanding of why it's so important that people have the autonomy, that they have they are able to exercise the right to decide what happens to their body and when the right time to create a family is. And this is just so extraordinarily devastating about the Alito opinion, is that the right of a human to decide when it's right for them to carry that precious life. And that, there's no language in that Alito opinion that recognizes the autonomy and the human right of people who have the ability to get pregnant. It's just astounding and devastating.
Yeah. You know, in our last discussion, which I will link to on the podcast page for this discussion, Jen, you spoke, we were speaking on in that other discussion about specifically about healthcare. And I wondered if you would say a little bit about the Turnaway study, because that what we were talking about, we were talking specifically about health. And there's so many people who believe that women and people who are having early abortions are not doing it for health reasons. But tell us a little bit about the Turnaway study.
So please look at it, because it's beautifully written up on the UCSF website where the study happened. They basically looked at individuals who were in fact turned away after they had made their decision that they could not carry this pregnancy. So a decision was made, I'm ready for my abortion. And they followed people who could actually not access that abortion for one reason or another. They were maybe one day too late in their pregnancy, depending on where they were accessing care. And those people who could not get the abortion that they wanted were matched with someone who got the abortion. So very closely matched in dates. And the results were so clear that those people who did not get the abortion that they had decided they needed had poorer economic status, less education, poorer mental health outcomes. If they had children and many of them, we know that people who have abortion often have children already, those children did not do as well. The data is just astounding. And I really encourage anyone who has any questions about whether an abortion is, you know, people do well after an abortion, look at this study. Of course, there are individuals who regret their decision, but that's true. I mean, the number of people who get married and then regret getting married to that person and get a divorce, we don't outlaw marriage because people later regret that decision. Yeah. It's just a very strange line of thinking that if someone regrets it, we need to outlaw it.
Yeah. And just to bring in another topic that is really current, that similar laws are being made against people. You know, it's okay to have plastic surgery because you want to be more beautiful. It's not okay to have plastic surgery because it affirms your gender. So there's a lot of disconnect when you start looking at these things, and really figuring out, you know, what are people reacting to? And again, you know, getting back to that stigma idea, that when you see disconnects like that, you can really see that the decisions that lawmakers make are so often not based on any facts or real outcomes, but rather a perception that is so much more important to them. And perhaps it's not even more important to the fact that they can transmit it easily to their voters. And But that's another whole discussion. So one last question about California and the sanctuary state status. So I know that there's just often a lot of frustration among people in California that we live in this place where our rights are secure and there are other places where they aren't. So what are some things that people listening can do to help people elsewhere who are having their rights to abortion taken away?
I have some thoughts. There are a number of organizations across the nation who raise funds to support folks to access abortion when they need them. One is the National Network of Abortion Funds, NNAF. Locally here in California, we have Access Women's Health Justice. They're easy to find if you do a quick search. There are some smaller grassroots organizations in the South who are particularly set up to help, for instance, people in Mississippi who are trying to access abortion. So there are a number of agencies that you can support financially to help folks access abortion now that it will be limited in other states. Mm-hmm.
As clinicians, I think we need to ready ourselves for being a sanctuary state in very real terms. And that includes educating and training more abortion providers for the future, including our primary care physicians for both early surgical and medical abortions. I think we need to encourage our men to speak about the issue. I can understand why men may be hesitant to talk on the topic because they don't want to step on the toes of women when this is primarily our issue, but I think we really need their voices and there is room for men's voices. And certainly men are impacted greatly by this Supreme Court decision. And we need to work on I'm going to come back to my big topic. We really need to work on being anti-racist and anti-sexist. We have so much work to do as a society.
Yeah, I think everything that's mentioned is extremely important. Funds will be needed throughout the U.S. in organizations that are supporting people to access abortion, resources for more training. And I think every person looking deeply at our rights in this country. And while it's hard to look at the language that's coming from the Supreme Court and hard to, you know, it's legalese and language we don't all understand, the contradiction in, for example, the opinion that was put out about gun controls and that the states could not make statewide, you know, by state decisions about whether you could own a gun, and yet that's exactly the opposite of philosophy or thought process was used about human, you know, people not being able to make a decision as to whether they would bring a life in the world. So really paying attention to what's happening in our country around legislation and human rights. This is an incredibly important time, and I'm afraid we're potentially losing very significant rights as we move forward. And I think each one of us has to look deeply and pay attention and not just think, oh, someone else will pay attention to that and act on it. We each need to step up.
I would just add, bringing what Jen, what you just said and what you said a little bit ago, Gail, about as professionals kind of call each other out to talk about it in our professional settings more and not be the bystander, you know, and really do bring it up in the public health setting, in our primary care clinic settings. And really, if you think about reproductive justice as a whole, that can be woven into any setting you work in, honestly. And so I would just add that, like, to really kind of hold each other accountable to, you know, bringing up this subject and not letting the stigma or the unknown prevent us from having the conversations in our professional settings, because we can say the A word. You know.
Yeah. So maybe bringing a group of friends together and talking about your own abortions or your reproductive stories.
And experiences of abortion providers as well. you know, there is a lot of stigma around that, you know, considered the kind of doing the dirty work. I had the opportunity to do a little qualitative study when I was with the Sea Change program, where we interviewed many abortion providers across the nation. And there's a huge amount of stigma that's experienced by folks who are providing this essential service. And that's something really to support those
almost,
folks.
Almost another level of coming out. I am an abortion provider, and I'm honored to be an abortion provider.
I want to thank you all for taking part in this program and dedicating your careers to public health. Jen, Gail, Pam, you're doing amazing work. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sophie, for having us.
Thank you for recognizing that and for being part of it.
Thanks very much for inviting me to the conversation, Sophie.
You've been listening to The Babblery. Please visit www.babblery.com for links and information related to this podcast.